Good morning. I'm John, one of the High Rock pastors, and it's my privilege to continue our series for the season of Lent. It's a season in which we take time to recognize and confess that Jesus is Lord. Looking at the world around us, sometimes it's hard to be sure. As I listen to and read the news each day, rather than seeing God in control, it seems like the world is out of control. Syrian refugees hardly seem better off after the collapse of ISIS. Turkey seems to be on the brink of war with Syria and Russia, threatening to drag the U.S. into it. In the meantime, we're trying to negotiate an exit from Afghanistan and our nation's longest war. But we're negotiating with the Taliban, and all the gains that were made in the past two decades appear to be at risk, especially for women. In the East, protests in Hong Kong have died down for now, but largely due to the fears of the COVID-19 coronavirus. This past year, global warming and climate change seemed out of control, literally setting the world on fire. Unprecedented fires in Australia even led to desperate animals turning to humans for help. Australia's unprecedented fires were immediately followed by unprecedented fires in Brazil. I keep seeing and hearing that word, unprecedented. With each new political scandal, I keep hearing about something that is unprecedented. And it's not just politics. Now it's economics, too. 2 weeks ago, we were seeing record highs in the stock market. But last week, due to uncertainty about the coronavirus, we saw an unprecedented stock market loss that was the biggest since the 2008 crash. Speaking of COVID-19, let's hope that's not unprecedented as well. If I didn't know better, I would think that unprecedented meant really bad or out of control. And on top of everything else, on top of everything else that is out of control, there's Justin Bieber's mustache. Something needs to be done. Get that under control. When the whole world feels like it's out of control, it can be tempting to hold on to what little control we have in our own private worlds. Maybe I can't control what's going on out there, but I can at least try to keep my family, my business, and my own personal life under control. But sometimes, our own private worlds are just as out of control as the world at large. I remember a time, not so long ago, that I was desperately struggling to keep my own world from spiraling out of control. When your life threatens to spiral out of control, where do you turn? For me, the answer was my own cleverness. But sometimes, no amount of clever can find a solution. When my wife Amy discovered that she was carrying a genetic mutation that had taken the life of her grandfather, her aunt, and even her own mother at a very young age, we were desperate to see if there was anything we could do. We visited and listened to genetic counselors. We consulted with doctors. I read the research and medical journals myself. I remember one time when the gastroenterologist finished doing a scope of Amy's stomach and said everything looked fine. He added that he had used the methylene blue dye that researchers had indicated was better at helping to spot potential tumors. And after he left the room, I said to my wife, "Amy, he's basing his methods on last year's research. But this year, those same researchers flipped the recommendation and said it was actually the Congo red dye, not the methylene blue, that was more critical." I was more current on the research than our Harvard-trained doctor. But all my cleverness was still not enough to save my wife from having her entire stomach removed, along with a double mastectomy and a dozen other surgeries and emergency room visits. My cleverness couldn't control the outcome. At around the same time, our youngest child, Eliza, was diagnosed with autism. Prior to that diagnosis, we had watched with deepening worry as she lost the few words she had. We had her hearing tested. We enrolled her in early intervention services. We drove her to experimental therapies in various research hospitals all around the city. We looked into every supposed cure for our child's condition. But once again, cleverness was not able to control the outcome for our daughter, who still remains nonverbal and in need of around-the-clock care. And then my brother Eugene, who had been such an essential support to our family, passed away unexpectedly on a Christmas morning. He had seemed ill the previous week, but since it was flu season, I didn't think much of it. After I found him in his apartment, I started putting the clues together. I quickly figured out that he had been showing signs of undiagnosed and untreated diabetes. When I spoke to the coroner, he confirmed that my suspicion was likely explanation for his death. Again, I was clever, but not in time to do anyone any good. In the meantime, our marriage was falling apart and our two other children were suffering, sometimes in silence. As I'm sure you can guess, my cleverness was not much help there either. My life was like sand. The more I tried to hold on tight to control it, the faster it slipped through my hands. Have you ever felt like control is slipping out of your fingers? When your life starts to feel a bit out of control, what do you do to restore a sense of order and peace? Maybe you're struggling in your marriage. Maybe your business or career is in transition. Maybe your finances are falling apart. Maybe your children are failing to thrive and you're not sure how to give them what they need. The Westermarks face that same challenge in their video life story that we just saw. When I ran into problems like that, I turned to my own cleverness. Where do you turn? Maybe you hunker down and just work harder than everyone else. Maybe you rely on others to give you the help you need. Maybe you have the kind of money or position where you can enlist outside resources and help. Or maybe you just worry. Sure, worry doesn't fix the problem, but at least it feels like you're doing something. And where does God fit into this picture? Does God even care that your life is unraveling at the seams? Lent is a 40-day period that Christians have set aside since the earliest centuries in order to prepare themselves spiritually for the forgiveness and joy of Easter. Part of the way we prepare is by reflecting on some of the sins that have slowly taken hold in our lives, repenting and refusing to make space for those any longer. Christians often fast from something like meat or shopping or sweets as a way of practicing self-denial and strengthening their spiritual muscles to resist the most sinister temptations we all face. Reaching for my phone first thing in the morning, envious of what others or what I missed out on, or angry or worried about what happened in the world. That habit will shape me over time. Reaching first for my phone will lead me in a very different direction than if I first turn to God in thankful prayer for another day and to give God's word an opportunity for renewed perspective. Doing that for one day will make very little difference, but doing it every day makes all the difference. There's an old saying that's worth repeating. Sow a thought, reap an action. Sow an action, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. Small changes over time can change your life in huge ways. So this Lent, our pastors identified 7 habits that are harming us. Over time, these habits can lead us to become people we don't like very much, or people who are missing out on the love and full life Jesus came to give us. This year, we're inviting you to unlearn some of those familiar habits that are harming us, and in their place, embrace some new habits that might heal us instead. And today, I'm starting us off by talking about the habit of taking control. In my life, I was facing each problem with a first and foremost mindset of turning to my cleverness. It's not that I didn't trust in God, but the habit of reaching first for cleverness was blinding me to the ways in which my trust in God was fading. Eventually, I even became angry at God for not blessing my efforts to take control. In the Bible passage that was read for us today, we see another example of someone who wanted to draw close to Jesus, but his desire for control instead led him far from Jesus and deeply grieved. We read from Mark 10, but this encounter was so meaningful that we find it also in Matthew 19 and Luke 18. Putting the details from all those recountings together, we see that this wealthy young community leader, often called the rich young ruler, came to Jesus wondering what he needed to do to share in the life that God's Messiah would bring about. Jesus responds in an interesting way. Jesus doesn't actually deny that he himself is good, but he calls into question any basis the young man might have for laying claim to being a good person. Jesus then gives him a test for goodness by listing out 5 of the 10 commandments. But Jesus seems to leave out the commands about putting God first. And very importantly, Jesus leaves out the final commandment about coveting and greed. The wealthy young man wasn't satisfied with Jesus' answer. He had done everything that Jesus mentioned, but something still was missing. And Jesus says, "You're right, something is still missing." Earlier, Jesus had left out the commands about putting God first, and he had left out the final commandment, "Do not covet, do not desire what others have." Apparently, Jesus had left those out because those were the missing piece, and it was a huge piece. Now realize that Jesus didn't ask everyone to sell everything and give it away. So why did he ask this rich young man to give away his wealth? Jesus seems to know that this man's heart was captivated by money, and he needed to be set free. Jesus doesn't make this demand to hurt the young man. Right before making this incredible demand of the young man, Jesus looked at him and loved him. If you feel Jesus challenging you today, remember that this is out of the same concern. Jesus looks at you and loves you. You matter to God. So how does the wealthy young man respond to Jesus' love? Does he receive it as liberation to finally be freed from the grip that money has had on his heart? No. His face fell. He went away sad, grieved, because he had great wealth and he couldn't let it go. He couldn't accept Jesus' invitation. He couldn't let go of his wealth. He could not let go of control. Earlier, I shared that my first impulse is to often turn to my cleverness. Cleverness tends to be my go-to strategy. Maybe that's because I never really had that kind of money. Now, there is nothing inherently wrong with wealth. The Bible often speaks of wealth as a blessing and a reward. The problem with wealth or cleverness or hard work or any other good thing, or even worry, is that we can be tempted to trust in ourselves and put ourselves first rather than trusting in God and putting the Lord first. It is often said that Jesus talked about money more than any other topic other than the kingdom of God itself. And it's probably because if people are going to be tempted to trust in something other than God to attain the good life, chances are good that it will be money. So Jesus says, you cannot serve both God and money. Of all the things that might displace God from the center of our hearts, money is the number one contender. In fact, in today's passage, Jesus goes on to say that money is almost an insurmountable problem for anyone who wants to follow God. It's easier to fit a camel through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to put God first. Jesus' words seem so challenging that throughout history, people have tried to soften his words. I've even heard a sermon in which a pastor told the story of how the eye of the needle was a special city gate that was so small that a camel could pass through it, but it had to kneel down and have all of its burdens removed in order to fit. Like this medieval church decoration in Germany. The problem is that there is no evidence that such a gate existed. And the whole idea seems to arise in the Middle Ages because people couldn't believe that rich people might find it impossible to enter God's kingdom. All the evidence points to Jesus referring to a literal eye of a needle. A camel was the biggest animal that most of Jesus' listeners would have ever seen. And Jesus was asking them to imagine fitting the biggest animal through the smallest opening. Impossible. And that's exactly how Jesus' disciples took it as well. If that's impossible, then what hope is there for the rest of us? For me, the temptation is to turn to cleverness rather than money. But whether it's cleverness or money or hard work or even worry, it doesn't matter. What matters is that my first impulse was to reach for something I could control rather than to reach out for the God who cannot be controlled. And though it felt cruel at the time to have my cleverness systematically fail me, I now see it as one of God's severe mercies. Because my trust in my own cleverness was really a trust in my own control. And not only was cleverness failing me with my wife's health, our daughter's autism, and my brother's life, I was wreaking destruction on my marriage and my children and ministry by trusting in my own control. I was trying to control them through my cleverness. And when that didn't work, more and more through my anger. It was less about love and more about manipulation. Elaine and Gary Westermark shared their story in their video life story that we saw today, and they shared how their attempts to control their own lives were failing them as well. It was only as they surrendered their lives to God's direction that they experienced the blessing that they could never secure for themselves. It was in surrendering to trust in God rather than to control that they experienced God's transforming power. You know, I always used to consider the Lord's Prayer a bit curious in several ways. I mean, for one thing, why do we pray for just our daily bread? I mean, why not pray for enough bread to plan for the future and to provide for others? When I asked that question as a new believer, someone pointed out that when the Israelites were in the desert, they received manna from heaven each day, enough for just that day. And to be sure, I think Jesus had that history in mind. But I think it goes beyond that. As I read through the Bible for myself, or as I read through the Bible for myself, I eventually came across a part of Proverbs which gives us more insight to the problem of having wealth. Proverbs 30 says, "Two things I ask of you, Lord. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep falsehood and lies far from me, and give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God." The disciples were tempted to think that wealth was a virtue, that it was a sign of God's blessing. If it's impossible for the rich to be saved, then who can be saved? But here we clearly see that both wealth and poverty are temptations to take matters into our own hands. Wealth and poverty are both temptations to seize control in ways that dishonor God and others. Why is money such a temptation? Because it's the easiest way for us to not have to trust God. The incredible irony is that God's blessing can become a curse. With wealth, I can convince myself that I'm trusting in God when I'm actually just building up a portfolio so I don't have to trust God at all. Instead, we're told to pray for our daily bread, to ask for God to provide what we need, but to hold on loosely to everything else. Did you know that that's what we're praying when you pray the Lord's Prayer? That we're praying for protection not only from poverty and need, we're also praying that God would protect us from wealth. We're praying that God would protect us from turning wealth into an idol. I know that for many of us, it seems strange that Israel struggled for so long with the sin of idolatry throughout its entire history. I mean, who cares about a little household idol or a golden calf? The temptation of idolatry, then as now, is that we want to trust in what we can control rather than in a God who cannot be controlled. Idolatry is all about wanting to be in control rather than being submitted to God, having to trust God. In Tim Keller's book, Gospel and Life, there's an entire chapter about idolatry and how it shows up in our lives as the sin underneath all other sins. According to Keller, whatever you turn to first to secure the good life is your idol. Inasmuch as I had been turning instinctively and primarily to my own cleverness, I was turning to an idol. I was turning to what I could control, my cleverness, rather than to the God whom I could never control. And the rich young ruler could not let go of his wealth because it was something he could control. Remember, Jesus looked at the young man and loved him. But the young man could not accept that love because it meant letting go of control and learning to trust, and he just couldn't do it. What is it that you are trusting in to secure the good life for yourself or for your family? When you think about how you can bless your friends or your children or your loved ones, what is it that you think of? Do you think of how you can bless them with God's love, God's truth and wisdom? Or is it something else? Maybe your money, your connections, your cleverness. Where do you turn for meaning and security? Is your first impulse to turn to God? Or like the rich young ruler, are you more likely to elevate good things like wealth or family into ultimate things, thus pushing God to the side? By trusting in his wealth, by trusting in what he could control rather than the God he could never control, the rich young ruler placed himself in such a spiritually compromised position that the only way he could experience true freedom in Christ was by losing everything. By the time I was in the interview process to join High Rock back in 2011, I felt like I had lost or nearly lost everything. Trusting in my cleverness felt safe, but in the end, my trust in what I could control had not saved my wife's health, it had not saved my daughter, it had not saved my brother, and it had almost cost me my marriage as well. Thank God, through loving sisters and brothers who were willing to challenge me as well as support me, I came to see how I had distanced myself from God. Cleverness and hard work were never going to be enough, especially if I wanted to teach and lead others into a life of faith and trust. As we gathered to close down my previous church and celebrate what God had done in our midst, a High Rocker asked me if I'd be interested in throwing my name in the hat for an open position at High Rock. I didn't make or find that connection. It wasn't something I could control. It was a gift from God who I could never control. As I went through the interview process, I quickly discovered that we shared the same ministry philosophy and values. After one of my answers, Pastor Eugene said, "It sounds like we're reading out of the same playbook. In fact, High Rock seemed to be everything that my former church had tried to be, yet failed to achieve. Again, it wasn't something I could control. God had given me something I had not been able to create through my own cleverness and hard work." Finally, it came down to an interview in which I sat in a big room with around a dozen High Rock staff members, and they all threw questions at me for over an hour. And finally, Pastor Dave asked me a question I could not have prepared for. He said, "You know, usually when we interview candidates, they're very eager to come work for us. They're knocking on my door to see where we are in the process. They try to get some clue as to what they can do to increase the chance that we'll hire them. But not you. You've been playing it real cool. Do you actually want to work for us?" And right away I said, wait. First of all, let me be very clear that I do want to work here. But if I've seemed non-anxious, it's because I'm trying really hard to not try and control the process. For the past several years, I've been learning to trust God rather than take control through my own cleverness and hard work. So if I've seemed laid back in this process, it's because I've been trying very hard to resist the temptation to try and take control of what seemed like a gift from God from the beginning. In other words, I was leaning into trusting a God that I cannot control. And leaning into that trust has been an incredible blessing. And that approach of starting with trust instead of control has transformed not only my career, but my marriage and my children as well. Where and how are you tempted to take control for yourself rather than trust God? How might we unlearn the patterns of control so we might learn the habits of trust? What habits might over time lead us little by little to a place of blessing rather than facing the possibility of losing it all, as happened to the rich young ruler? What do we need to unlearn and learn in its place? Sometimes the temptation to take control might be so great that the only way to free ourselves is to experience God is to give it up. Like Jesus said to the rich young ruler, "Give it all away." But that was an exceptional case, even in the Gospels. For many of us, moving from control to trust is more of a habit of turning first to God rather than turning to God only after everything has fallen apart. I mentioned earlier that one habit I've had to unlearn is turning first to my phone. It can be so tempting to look at my calendar or my notifications. It can be so distracting to pore over social media notifications that highlight the ways I've been missing out on what my friends seem to be enjoying. It can also be so tempting to focus first on the news and what new, unprecedented thing is reason for concern or anger. Instead, I want to encourage you to turn first to God. Start your day by engaging with God. For some of you, that might mean prayer, or maybe a time of worship or journaling, or maybe taking a walk and finding a private place to be with God. I think of it like tuning an instrument. Before a guitarist plays, you see them tuning their instrument. Maybe this first moment of the day is a time to get in tune with God, to be in harmony with God. If you don't have a morning ritual, let me suggest simply praying through the Lord's Prayer. Develop it as a habit until it becomes second nature, until it's your first thought of the day and the words start pouring out of your mouth even before your feet hit the floor. And pay special attention when you get to the part about daily bread. Remember, you're asking God for God's provision today so that you have a daily dependence, not so much that you become proud and not so little that you're tempted to lie, cheat, or steal. Enough strength for today, enough wisdom for today, enough energy for today. Start your day by turning to God. Then you'll be ready to engage with the world out of trust in God rather than a need to control. Second, as you go through your day, you'll face challenges and problems, and in those moments, ask God to direct your thoughts and actions. If you're like me, chances are you're not going to suddenly hear the voice of God or experience direct divine inspiration, but trust that God's Spirit is helping to direct you simply because you asked. By turning first to God instead of immediately to your cleverness or authority or skill or personality, you'll probably start to experience a sense of gratitude and purpose rather than pride. Third suggestion. As you go through your day, or maybe when you get home, you're probably going to want to experience some encouragement or refreshment. For many of us, that might mean turning to food or drink or entertainment. Netflix and chill has become almost a national pastime, or TikTok, apparently. And there's nothing wrong with any of those good things. But like with anything, a good thing can become a bad thing when we constantly turn to it first. Instead, when you need encouragement or refreshment, find a way to take delight in God. Maybe take a walk, or find a way to experience joy by bringing joy to someone else. Maybe go outside and throw a ball around. Or maybe enjoy the same food or drink or entertainment that you were going to enjoy, but do it mindfully, receiving it as a gift from God rather than something you manage and control on your own. I also have a fourth and final suggestion for unlearning control and learning to trust. I mentioned in my story that I had good sisters and brothers who were willing to challenge and encourage me. One of the best ways to remind yourself that you're not in control is to rely on others for support. Find a few trusted people and make a commitment to one another to check in with each other and ask, "How is God engaging with you today? How are you learning to trust rather than take control?" Another way to do the same thing is to take the unlearn cards, fill them out, and then share what you wrote with someone else. And finally, one more thing. It's not part of the list, it's just an encouragement. In my reliance on cleverness, I had to learn to seek the advice of others and discover that I wasn't so clever after all. Maybe you don't have to give up all your money. Maybe you need to learn to give up control of your money. Maybe you could submit your finances to a trusted friend for them to review, someone who could help you discern how you might be more God-honoring with the blessings God has given you. If you need even the most basic help with that, we have a Fearless Finances seminar coming up on Saturday, April 25th, over in Arlington. It's a seminar that a High Rocker provides as a personal ministry that comes out of his own messy financial history and relationship with money. This season of Lent has only just begun. May today be a time when we consider how God is inviting us to unlearn the habits that have held us captive and to learn new habits that will lead us to freedom and joy and blessing from God.